Well, I must say I'm relieved to hear that, said Mrs. Barber coolly, since the main branch is closed on Mondays.
I didn't say he was at the main branch, Mother.
I think you might actually know him, I said, anxious to draw fire from Andy. Know of him, anyway.
Who?
Said Mrs. Barber, her gaze coming back to me. The friend I was visiting. His name is James Hobart. He runs a furniture shop downtown. Well, doesn't run it. He does the restorations. She brought her eyebrows down and looked at me.
Hobart?
He works for lots of people in the city. Sotheby's sometimes.
You wouldn't mind if I gave him a call, then?
No, I said defensively. He said we should all go out to lunch. Or maybe you'd like to come down to his shop sometime.
Oh,
said Mrs. Barber, after a beat or two of surprise. Now she was the one thrown off balance. If Mrs. Barber ever went south of 14th Street for any reason whatsoever, I didn't know about it.
Well, we'll see.
Not to buy anything, just to look. He has some nice things. She blinked.
Of course, she said.
She seemed strangely disoriented, something fixed and distracted about the eyes.
Well, lovely. I'm sure I would enjoy meeting him. Have I met him?
No, I don't think so.
In any case, Andy, I'm sorry. I owe you an apology. You too, Theo.
Me? I didn't know what to say. Andy, sucking furtively at the side of his thumb, gave a one-shouldered shrug as she spun out of the room.
What's the matter?
I asked him quietly.
She's upset. It's nothing to do with you. Platt's home, he added.
Now that he mentioned it, I was aware of muffled music emanating from the rear of the apartment, a deep, subliminal thump.
Why?
I said. What's wrong?
Something happened at school.
Something bad?
God knows,
he said tonelessly. He's in trouble?
I assume so. No one will talk about it.
But what happened? Andy made a face.
Who knows? He was here when we got home from school. We heard his music. Kitsy was excited and ran back to tell him hello, but he screamed and slammed the door in her face.
I winced. Kitsy idolized Platt.
Then Mother came home. She's been back in his room. Then she was on the telephone for a while. I slightly think Daddy's on his way home now. They were supposed to have dinner with the Ticknors tonight, but I think that's been canceled.
What about supper? I said after a brief pause. Normally, on school nights, we ate in front of a television while doing our homework, but with Platt home, Mr. Barber on his way, and the evening's plans abandoned, it was starting to look more like a family dinner in the dining room. Andy straightened his glasses in the fussy, old womanish way he had. Although my hair was dark and his was light, I was only too aware how the identical eyeglasses Mrs. Barber had chosen for us made me look like Andy's egghead twin, especially since I'd overheard some girl at school calling us the Goofus Brothers, or maybe the Doofus Brothers, whatever, it wasn't a compliment.
Let's walk over to Serendipity and get a hamburger, he said. I'd really rather not be here when Daddy gets home.
Take me too,
said Kitsy unexpectedly, galloping in and stopping just short of us, flushed and breathless. Andy and I looked at each other. Kitsy didn't even like to be seen standing in line next to us at the bus stop.
Please,
she wailed, looking back and forth between us.
Toddy's doing soccer practice. I have my own money. I don't want to be by myself with them. Please.
Oh, come on, I said to Andy, and she flashed me a grateful look. Andy put his hands in his pockets.
All right, then,
he said to her, expressionlessly. They were a pair of white mice, I thought. Only Kitsy was a spun sugar fairy princess mouse, whereas Andy was more the kind of luckless, anemic pet shop mouse you might feed to your boa constrictor.
Get your stuff.
Go, he said when she still stood there staring.
I'm not waiting for you. And don't forget your money because I'm not paying for you either.
13.
I didn't go down to Hobie's for the next few days, out of loyalty to Andy, although I was greatly tempted in the atmosphere of tension that hung over the household. Andy was right. It was impossible to figure out what Platt had done, since Mr. and Mrs. Barber behaved as if absolutely nothing were wrong, only you could tell that something was, and Platt himself wouldn't say a word, only sat sullenly at meals with his hair hanging in his face.
"Believe me," said Andy, "it's better when you're around. They talk and make more of an effort to be normal."
"What do you think he did?"
"Honestly, I don't know. I don't want to know."
"Sure you do."
"Well, yes,"
said Andy, relenting.
"But I really don't have the foggiest."
"Do you think he cheated? Stole? Chewed gum in chapel?"
Andy shrugged.
"The last time he was in trouble, it was for hitting somebody in the face with a lacrosse stick. But that wasn't like this."
And then, out of the blue,
"Mother loves Platt the best."
"You think?"
I said, evasively, though I knew very well this was true.
"Daddy loves Kitsy best, and Mother loves Platt."
"She loves Toddy a lot, too,"
I said, before realizing quite how this sounded. Andy grimaced.
"I would think I'd been switched at birth," he said, "if I didn't look so much like Mother."
14. For some reason, during this strained interlude, maybe because Platt's mysterious trouble reminded me of my own, it occurred to me that maybe I ought to tell Hobie about the painting, or, at the very least, broach the subject in some oblique manner to see what his reaction would be. The difficulty was how to bring it up. It was still in the apartment, exactly where I'd left it, in the bag I'd brought out of the museum, when I'd seen it leaning against the sofa in the front room. On the dreadful afternoon I'd gone back in to get some school things I needed, I'd walked right past it, skirting it as assiduously as I would have a grasping bum on the sidewalk, and all the time feeling Mrs. Barber's cool, pale eye on my back, on our apartment, on my mother's things, as she stood in the door with her arms folded. It was complicated. Every time I thought of it, my stomach squirmed, so that my first instinct was to slam the lid down hard and think of something else. Unfortunately, I'd waited so long to say anything to anybody that it was starting to feel like it was too late to say anything at all. And the more time I spent with Hobie, with his crippled Hepplewhites and Chippendales, the old things he took such diligent care of, the more I felt it was wrong to keep silent. What if someone found the picture? What would happen to me? For all I knew, the landlord might have gone into the apartment. He had a key, but even if he did go in, I didn't think he would necessarily happen upon it. Yet I knew I was tempting fate by leaving it there while I put off deciding what to do. It wasn't that I minded giving it back. If I could have returned it magically by wishing, I would have done it in a second. It was just that I couldn't think how to return it in a way that wouldn't endanger either me or the painting. Since the museum bombing, there were notices all over the city saying that packages left unattended for any reason would be destroyed, which did away with most of my brilliant ideas for returning it anonymously. Any suspicious suitcase or parcel would be blown up, no questions asked. Of all the adults I knew, there were only two I considered taking into my confidence, Hobie or Mrs. Barber. Of these, Hobie seemed by far the more sympathetic and least terrifying prospect. It would be much easier to explain to Hobie how I had happened to take the painting out of the museum in the first place. That it was a mistake, sort of. That I'd been following Welty's instruction. That I'd had a concussion. That I hadn't fully considered what I was doing. That I hadn't meant to let it sit around so long. Yet in my homeless limbo, it seemed insane to step up and admit to what I knew a lot of people were going to view as very serious wrongdoing. Then, by coincidence, just as I was realizing I really couldn't wait much longer before I did something, I happened to see a tiny black and white photo of the painting in the business section of the Times. Due perhaps to the unease that had overtaken the household in the wake of Platt's disgrace, the newspaper now occasionally found its way out of Mr. Barber's study,
where it disassembled itself and reappeared a page or two at a time. These pages, awkwardly folded, were scattered near a napkin-wrapped glass of club soda, Mr. Barber's calling card, on the coffee table in the living room. It was a long, boring article, toward the back of the section, having to do with the insurance industry, about the financial difficulties of mounting big art shows in a troubled economy, and especially the difficulty in insuring traveling artworks. But what had caught my eye was the caption under the photo. The Goldfinch, Carol Fabritius's 1654 masterpiece. Destroyed. Without thinking, I sat down in Mr. Barber's chair and began scanning the dense text for any further mention of my painting. Already I'd begun to think of it as mine. The thought slid into my head as if I'd owned it all my life. Questions of international law come into play in cultural terrorism such as this, which has sent a chill through the financial community as well as the artistic world. The loss of even one of these pieces is impossible to quantify, said Murray Twitchell, a London-based insurance risk analyst. Along with the 12 pieces lost and presumed destroyed, another 27 works were badly damaged, although restoration, for some, is possible. In what may seem a futile gesture to many, the Art Loss Database... The story was continued on the next page, but just then Mrs. Barber came into the room and I had to put the newspaper down.
Theo, she said, I have a proposal for you.
Yes, I said, warily.
Would you like to come up to Maine with us this year?
For a moment, I was so overjoyed that I went completely blank.
Yes,
I said.
Wow, that'd be great.
Even she couldn't help but smile, a bit.
Well, she said, Chance will certainly be happy to put you to work on the boat. It seems that we're going out somewhat earlier this year. Well, Chance and the children will be going early. I'll be staying in the city to take care of some things, but I'll be up in a week or two.
I was so happy I couldn't think of a single thing to say.
We'll see how you like sailing.
Perhaps you'll like it better than Andy does. Let us hope so, at any rate.
You think it's going to be fun, said Andy gloomily when I ran back to the bedroom. Ran, not walked, to give him the good news.
But it's not. You'll hate it.
All the same, I could tell exactly how pleased he was. And that night, before bed, he sat down with me on the edge of the bottom bunk to talk about what books we would bring, what games, and what the symptoms of seasickness were, so that I could get out of helping on deck, if I felt like it. 15. This twofold news, good on both fronts, left me limp and dazed with relief. If my painting was destroyed, if that was the official story, there was plenty of time to decide what to do. By the same magic, Mrs. Barber's invitation seemed to extend beyond the summer and far into the horizon, as if the entire Atlantic Ocean lay between me and Grandpa Decker. The lift was dizzying, and all I could do was exult in my reprieve. I knew that I should give the painting to either Hobie or Mrs. Barber, throw myself on their mercy, tell them everything, beg them to help me. In some bleak, lucid corner of my mind, I knew I would be sorry if I didn't. But my mind was too full of Maine and sailing to think about anything else, and it was starting to occur to me that it might even be smart to keep the painting for a while, as a sort of insurance for the next 3 years, against having to go live with Grandpa Decker and Dorothy. It is a hallmark of my stunning naivete that I thought I might even be able to sell it if I had to. So I kept quiet, looked at maps and chart markers with Mr. Barber, and let Mrs. Barber take me to Brooks Brothers to buy some deck shoes and some light cotton sweaters to wear on the water when it got cool at night, and said nothing. 16.
Too much education was my problem, said Hobie, or so my father thought.
I was in the workshop with him, and helping sort through endless pieces of old cherry wood, some redder, some browner, all salvaged from old furniture, to get the exact shade he needed to patch the apron of the tall case clock he was working on.
My father had a trucking company.
This I already knew. The name was so famous that even I was familiar with it.
And in the summers and over Christmas vacation, he had me loading trucks. I'd have to work up to driving one, he said. The men on the loading docks all went dead silent the moment I walked out there. Boss's son, you know. Not their fault, because my father was a holy bastard to work for. Anyway, he had me doing that from 14, after school and on weekends, loading boxes in the rain. Sometimes I worked in the office, too. Dismal, dingy place. Freezing in winter and hot as blazes in summer, shouting over the exhaust fans. At first it was only in the summers and over Christmas vacation, but then, after my second year of college, he announced he wasn't paying my tuition anymore.
I had found a piece of wood that looked like a good match for the broken piece, and I slid it over to him.
Did you have bad grades?
No, I did all right, he said,
picking up the wood and holding it to the light, then putting it in the stack with possible matches.
The thing was, he hadn't gone to college himself, and he'd done fine, hadn't he? Did I think I was better than him? But more than that, well, he was the kind of man who had to bully everyone around him, you know the type. And I think it must have dawned on him, what better way to keep me under his thumb and working for free? At first, he told me I'd have to take a year off, 4 years, five, however long it took, and earn the rest of my college money the hard way. Never saw a penny I made. I lived at home, and he was putting it all into a special account, you see, for my own good. Rough enough, but fair, I thought. But then, after I'd worked full-time for him for about 3 years, the game changed. Suddenly, he laughed. Well, hadn't I understood the deal? I was paying him back for my first 2 years of college. He hadn't set aside anything at all.
That's awful,
I said, after a shocked pause. I didn't see how he could laugh about something so unfair.
Well, he rolled his eyes. I was still a bit green, but I realized at that rate, I'd be perishing of old age before I ever got out of there. But no money, nowhere to live. What was I to do? I was trying hard to figure something out when, lo and behold, Welty happened into the office one day while my father was going off at me. He loved to berate me in front of his men, my dad, swaggering around like a mafia boss, saying I owed him money for this and that, taking it out of my quote-unquote salary, withholding my alleged paycheck for some imaginary infraction, that kind of thing. Welty, it wasn't the first time I'd seen him. He'd been in the office to arrange for shipping from estate sales. He always claimed that, with his back, he had to work harder to make a good impression, make people see past the deformity and all that. But I liked him from the start. Most people did. My father, even, who, shall I say, wasn't a man who took kindly to people. At any rate, Welty, having witnessed this outburst, telephoned my father the next day and said he could use my help packing the furniture for a house he'd bought the contents of. I was a big, strong kid, hard worker, just the ticket. Well, Hobie stood and stretched his arms over his head. Welty was a good customer, and my father, for whatever reason, said yes. The house I helped him pack was the old DePeyster mansion, and as it happened, I'd known old Mrs. DePeyster quite well. From the time I was a kid, I'd liked to wander down and visit her. Funny old woman in a bright yellow wig, font of information, papers everywhere, knew everything about local history, incredibly entertaining storyteller. Anyway, it was quite a house, packed with Tiffany glass and some very good furniture from the 1800s, and I was able to help with the provenance of a lot of the pieces, better than Mrs. DePeyster's daughter, who hadn't the slightest interest in the chair President McKinley had sat in, or any of that. The day I finished helping him with the house, it was about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I was head to toe with dust. Welty opened a bottle of wine, and we sat around on the packing cases and drank it. You know, bare floors, and that empty house echo. I was exhausted. He'd paid me directly, cash, leaving my father out of it. And when I thanked him and asked if he knew of any more work, he said, "Look, I've just opened a shop in New York, and if you want a job, you've got it." So we clinked glasses on it, and I went home, packed a suitcase full of books mostly, said goodbye to the housekeeper, and hitched a ride on the truck to New York the next day. Never looked back.
A lull ensued. We were still sorting through the veneer, clicking fragments, paper thin, like counters in some ancient game from China, maybe. An eerie lightness in the sound which made you feel lost in some much larger silence. "Hey," I said, spotting a piece and snatching it up, passing it to him triumphantly, exact color match, closer than any of the pieces he'd set aside in his pile. He took it from me, looked at it under the lamp.
"It's all right."
"What's wrong with it?"
"Well, you see,"
he put the veneer up to the clock's apron.
"This kind of work, it's the grain of the wood you really have to match. That's the trick of it. Variations in tone are easier to fudge. Now this,"
he held up a different piece, visibly several shades off,
"with a little beeswax and a bit of the right coloring, maybe. Bichromate of potash, touch of Van Dyke brown, sometimes with a grain really difficult to match, certain kinds of walnut especially. I've used ammonia to darken a bit of new wood, but only when I was desperate. It's always best to use wood of the same vintage as the piece you're repairing, if you have it."
"How'd you learn how to do all this?" I said, after a timid pause. He laughed.
"The same way you're learning it now. Standing around and watching. Making myself useful."
"Welty taught you?"
"Oh, no. He understood it. Knew how it was done. You have to in this business. He had a very reliable eye, and often I'd bob up and fetch him when I wanted a second opinion. But before I joined the enterprise, usually he'd pass on a piece that needed restoration. It's time-consuming work. Takes a certain mindset. He didn't have the temperament nor the physical hardiness for it. He much preferred the acquisitions end, you know, going to auction, or being in the shop and chatting up the customers. Every afternoon around 5, I'd pop up for a cup of tea. Scourged from your dungeons. It really was pretty foul down here in the old days with the mold and damp. When I came to work for Welty," he laughed, "he had this old fellow named Abner Mossbank. Bad legs, arthritis in his fingers, could barely see. It would take him a year sometimes to finish a piece. But I stood at his back and watched him work. He was like a surgeon. Couldn't ask questions. Absolute silence. But he knew absolutely everything. Work that other people didn't know how to do or cared to learn anymore. It hangs by a thread, this trade, generation to generation."
"Your dad never gave you the money you earned?" He laughed warmly.
"Not a penny. Never spoke to me again, either. He was a bitter old sod. Fell down dead of a heart attack in the middle of firing one of his oldest employees. One of the most poorly attended funerals you'd ever care to see. 3 black umbrellas in the sleet. Hard not to think of Ebenezer Scrooge."
"You never went back to college?"
"No. Didn't want to. I'd found what I liked to do. So?"
He put both hands in the small of his back and stretched. His out-at-elbows jacket, loose and a bit dirty, made him look like a good-natured groom on his way to the stables.
"Moral of the story is, who knows where it will all take you."
"All what?"
He laughed. "Your sailing holiday," he said, moving to the shelf,
where the jars of pigment were arrayed like potions in an apothecary. Ochreous earths, poisonous greens, powders of charcoal and burnt bone.
"Might be the decisive moment. It takes some people that way. The sea."
Andy gets seasick. He has to carry a baggie on the boat to throw up in. Well, reaching for a jar of lamp black, must admit, it never took me that way. When I was a kid, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, those Doré illustrations. No, the ocean gives me the shivers. But then I'd never been on an adventure like yours. You never know, because... Brow furrowed, tapping out a bit of soft black powder on his palette. I never dreamed that all that old furniture of Mrs. de Peyster's would be the thing that decided my future. Maybe you'll get fascinated by hermit crabs and study marine biology, or decide you want to build boats, or be a marine painter, or write the definitive book about the Lusitania. Maybe, I said, hands behind my back. But what I really hoped, I didn't dare articulate. Even to think of it practically made me tremble. Because the thing was, Kitsy and Toddy had started being much, much nicer to me, as if someone had drawn them aside. And I'd seen glances, subtle cues, between Mr. and Mrs. Barber that made me hopeful, more than hopeful. In fact, it was Andy who'd put the thought in my head.
They think being around you is good for me,
he'd said on the way to school the other day.
That you're drawing me out of my shell and making me more social. I'm thinking they might make a family announcement once we get up to Maine.
Announcement?
Don't be a dunce. They've grown quite fond of you. Mother especially, but Daddy too. I believe they may want to keep you.
16. I rode back uptown on the bus, slightly drowsy, swaying comfortably back and forth and watching the wet Saturday streets flash by. When I stepped inside the apartment, chilled from walking home in the rain, Kitsy ran into the foyer to stare at me, wild-eyed and fascinated, as if I was an ostrich who had wandered into the apartment. Then, after a few blank seconds, she darted off into the living room, sandals clattering on the parquet floor, crying,
Mom, he's here.
Mrs. Barber appeared.
Hello, Theo,
she said. She was perfectly composed, but there was something constrained in her manner, though I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
Come in here. I've got a surprise for you.
I followed her into Mr. Barber's study, gloomy in the overcast afternoon, with the framed nautical charts and the rain streaming down the gray window panes were like a theatrical set of a ship's cabin on a storm-tossed sea. Across the room, a figure rose from a leather club chair.
Hi, buddy, he said. Long time no see.
I stood frozen in the doorway. The voice was unmistakable.
My father.
He stepped forward into the weak light from the window. It was him, all right, though he'd changed since I'd seen him. He was heavier, tanned, puffy in the face, with a new suit and a haircut that made him look like a downtown bartender. In my dismay, I glanced back to Mrs. Barber, and she gave me a bright but helpless smile as if to say,
I know, but what can I do?
While I stood speechless with shock, another figure rose and elbowed forward in front of my father.
Hi, I'm Sandra,
said a throaty voice. I found myself confronted by a strange woman, tan and very fit-looking, flat gray eyes, lined coppery skin, and teeth that went in with a split between them. Although she was older than my mother, or at any rate older-looking, she was dressed like someone younger. Red platform sandals, low-slung jeans, wide belt, lots of gold jewelry. Her hair, the color of caramel straw, was very straight and tattered at the ends. She was chewing gum, and a strong smell of juicy fruit was coming off her.
It's Sandra with an X,
she said in a gravelly undertone. Her eyes were clear and colorless, with spikes of dark mascara around them. And her gaze was powerful, confident, unwavering.
Not Sandra, and God knows not Sandy. I get that one a lot, and it drives me up the wall.
As she spoke, my astonishment was growing by the moment. I couldn't quite take her in. Her whiskey voice, her muscular arms, the Chinese character tattooed on her big toe, her long, square fingernails with the white tips painted on, her earrings shaped like starfish.
We just got into LaGuardia about 2 hours ago, said my dad, clearing his throat, as if this explained everything. Was this who my dad had left us for?
In stupefaction, I looked back to Mrs. Barber again, only to see that she had vanished.
Theo? I'm out in Las Vegas now, my father said, looking at the wall somewhere over my head.
He still had the controlled, assertive voice of his actorly training, but though he sounded as authoritative as ever, I could see that he wasn't any more comfortable than I was.
I guess I should have called, but I thought it would be easier if we just came on out to get you.
Get me? I said, after a long pause.
Tell him, Larry, said Zandra, and then to me, you should be proud of your pops. He's on the wagon. How many days sobriety now? 51? Did it all on his own, too. Didn't even check himself into the joint. Detoxed on the sofa with a basket of Easter candy and a bottle of Valium.
Because I was too embarrassed to look at her or my father, I looked back at the doorway again and saw Kitsy Barber standing in the hall listening to all this with big, round eyes.
Because, I mean, I just couldn't put up with it, said Zandra,
in a tone suggesting that my mother had condoned and encouraged my dad's alcoholism.
I mean, my mom's was the kind of lush who would throw up in her glass of Canadian Club and then drink it anyway. And one night I said to him, Larry, I'm not going to say to you, never drink again. And frankly, I think that AA is way too much for the level of problem you have.
My father cleared his throat and turned to me with a genial face he usually reserved for strangers. Maybe he had stopped drinking, but still he had a bloated, shiny, slightly stunned look, as if he'd been living for the past 8 months off rum drinks and Hawaiian party platters.
Son, he said, we're right off the plane, and we came over because we wanted to see you right away, of course.
I waited.
We need the key to the apartment.
This was all moving a little too fast for me. The key? I said.
We can't get in over there, said Zandra bluntly. We tried already.
The thing is,
Theo, my dad said, his tone clear and cordial, running a businesslike hand over his hair.
I need to get in over at Sutton Place and see what's what. I'm sure things are a mess over there, and somebody needs to get in there and start taking care of stuff.
If you didn't leave things such a goddamn mess. These were words I'd heard my father scream at my mother when, about 2 weeks before he vanished, they'd had the biggest fight I ever heard them have, when the diamond and emerald earrings that belonged to her mother vanished from the dish on her bedside table. My father, red in the face, mocking her in a sarcastic falsetto, had said it was her fault. Chinzia had probably taken them, or who the hell knew. It wasn't a good idea to leave jewelry lying out like that, and maybe this would teach her to look after her things better. But my mother, ash white with anger, had pointed out in a cold, still voice that she'd taken the earrings off on Friday night, and that Chinzia hadn't been into work since.
What the hell are you trying to say?
Bellowed my father. Silence.
So I'm a thief now, is that it? You're accusing your own husband of stealing jewelry from you? What the hell kind of sick, irrational thing is that? You need help, you know that? You really need professional help.
Only it wasn't just the earrings that had vanished. After he vanished himself, it turned out that some other things, including cash and some antique coins belonging to her father, had vanished as well. And my mother had changed the locks and warned Chinzia and the doorman not to let him in if he showed up when she was at work. And of course everything was different, and there was nothing to stop him from going in the apartment and going through her belongings and doing with them what he liked. But as I stood looking at him and trying to think what the hell to say, half a dozen things were running through my mind, and chief among them was the painting. Every day, for weeks, I told myself that I would go over and take care of it, figure it out somehow. But I'd kept putting it off and putting it off. And now here he was. My dad was still smiling at me fixedly. Okay, buddy? Think you might want to help us out? Maybe he wasn't drinking anymore, but all the old late afternoon wanting a drink edge was still there, scratchy as sandpaper. I don't have the key, I said.
That's okay,
my dad returned swiftly. We can call a locksmith. Xander, give me the phone. I thought fast. I didn't want them to go in the apartment without me. Jose or Goldie might let us in, I said, if I go over there with you.
Fine then, said my dad. Let's go.
From his tone, I suspected he knew I was lying about the key, safely hidden in Andy's room. I knew, too, he didn't like the sound of involving the doorman, as most of the guys who worked in the building didn't care that much for my father, having seen him the worse for drink a few too many times. But I met his eye as blankly as I could, until he shrugged and turned away. 17.
Hola, Jose. Bomba!
Cried Jose, doing a happy step backward when he saw me on the sidewalk. He was the youngest and most buoyant of the doormen, always trying to sneak away before his shift was over to play soccer in the park.
Tío, ¿qué lo que, manito?
His uncomplicated smile threw me back hard to the past. Everything was the same. Green awning, sallow shade, same furry brown puddle, collecting in the sunken place in the sidewalk. Standing before the Art Deco doors, nickel bright, rayed with abstract sunbursts, doors that urgent news guys and fedoras might push through in a 1930s movie. I remembered all the times I'd stepped through them to find my mother sorting through her mail, waiting for the elevator. Fresh from work, heels and briefcase, with the flowers I'd sent for her birthday. Well, what do you know? My secret admirer has struck again. Jose, looking past me, had spotted my father and Xandra, hanging back slightly.
Hello, Mr. Decker,
he said, in a more formal tone, reaching around me to take my dad's hand, politely, but no love lost.
It's nice to see you.
My father, with his personable smile, started to answer, but I was too nervous and interrupted.
Jose,
I'd been racking my brains for the Spanish on the way over, rehearsing the sentence in my mind.
Mi papa quiere entrar el apartamento. Nosotros le necesitamos desatrancar la puerta.
Then, quickly, I slipped in the question I'd worked out earlier, on the way over.
¿Vendrá usted arriba con nosotros?
Jose's eyes went quickly to my father and Xandra. He was a big, handsome guy from the Dominican Republic, something about him reminiscent of the young Muhammad Ali. Sweet-tempered, always kidding around, but you didn't want to mess with him. Once, in a moment of confidence, he had pulled up his uniform jacket and shown me a knife scar on his abdomen, which he said he'd gotten in a street fight in Miami.
Happy to do it,
he said in English, in an easy voice. He was looking at them, but I knew he was talking to me.
I'll take you up. Everything is okay?
Yep, we're fine,
said my dad curtly. He was the very one who'd insisted that I study Spanish as my foreign language instead of German.
So at least one person in the family can communicate with these fucking doormen.
Xandra, whom I was starting to think was a real dingbat, laughed nervously and said in her stuttery, quick voice,
Yeah, we're fine, but the flight really took it out of us. It's a long way from Vegas, and we're still a little...
And here she rolled her eyes and waggled her fingers to indicate wooziness.
Oh, yeah?
Said Jose.
Today? You flew into La Guardia?
Like all the doormen, he was a genius at small talk, especially if it was about traffic or weather, the best route to the airport at rush hour.
I heard big delays out there today. Some problem with the baggage handlers, the union, right?
All the way up on the elevator, Xandra kept up a steady but agitated stream of chatter about how dirty New York was compared to Las Vegas.
Yeah, I admit it. Everything's cleaner out west. I guess I'm spoiled.
About her bad turkey sandwich on the airplane and the flight attendant who forgot, Xandra with her fingertips inserting the quotations manually, to bring Zandra the $5 change from the wine she ordered.
"Oh, ma'am,"
said Jose, stepping in the hallway, wagging his head in the mock serious way he had.
"Airplane food is the worst. These days, you're lucky if they feed you at all. Tell you one thing in New York, though. You're going to find some good food. You got good Vietnamese, good Cuban, good Indian. I don't like all that spicy stuff."
"Good. Whatever you want, then. We got it.
Segundito,"
he said, holding up a finger as he felt around on the ring for the passkey. The lock tumbled with a solid clunk, instinctive, blood deep in its rightness. Though the place was stuffy from being shut up, still I was leveled by the fierce smell of home, books and old rugs and lemon floor cleaner, the dark myrrh-smelling candles she bought at Barney's. The bag from the museum was propped on the floor by the sofa, exactly where I'd left it. How many weeks before? Feeling lightheaded, I darted around and inside to grab it as Jose, slightly blocking my irritated father's path without quite appearing to, stood just outside the door listening to Zandra, arms folded. The composed but slightly absent-minded look on his face reminded me of the way he'd looked when he'd had to practically carry my dad upstairs one freezing night. My dad so drunk he'd lost his overcoat.
"Happens in the best of families,"
he'd said with an abstract smile, refusing the $20 bill that my father, incoherent, vomit on his suit jacket, scratched up and dirty like he'd been rolling on the sidewalk, was trying hard to push into his face.
"Actually, I'm from the East Coast," Zandra was saying. "From Florida."
Again that nervous laugh, stuttery, sputtering.
"West Palm, to be specific."
"Florida, you say?"
I heard Jose remark.
"It's beautiful down there."
"Yeah, it's great. At least in Vegas we've got the sunshine. I don't know if I could take the winters out here. I'd turn into a popsicle."
The instant I picked the bag up, I realized it was too light, almost empty. Where the hell was the painting? Though I was almost blind with panic, I didn't stop, but I kept going down the hallway on autopilot, back to my bedroom, mind whirring and grinding as I walked. Suddenly, through my disconnected memories of that night, it came back to me. The bag was wet. I hadn't wanted to leave the picture in a wet bag to mildew or melt or who knew what. Instead, how could I have forgotten? I'd set it on my mother's bureau, the first thing she'd see when she came home. Quickly, without stopping, I dropped the bag in the hallway outside the closed door of my bedroom and turned into my mother's room, lightheaded with fear, hoping that my father wasn't following, but too afraid to look back and see. From the living room, I heard Zandra say,
"I bet you see a lot of celebrities on the street here, huh?"
"Oh, yeah. LeBron, Dan Aykroyd, Tara Reid, Jay-Z, Madonna."
My mother's bedroom was dark and cool, and the faint, just detectable smell of her perfume was almost more than I could bear. There sat the painting, propped among silver-framed photographs. Her parents, her, me at many ages, horses and dogs galore, her father's mare chalkboard, Bruno the Great Dane, her dachshund Poppy, who died when I was in kindergarten. Steeling myself against her reading glasses on the bureau, and her black tights stiff where she'd draped them to dry, and her handwriting on her desk calendar, and a million other heart-piercing sights, I picked it up and tucked it under my arm and walked quickly into my own room across the hall. My room, like the kitchen, faced the air shaft and was dark without the lights on. A dank bath towel lay crumpled where I'd thrown it after my shower that last morning, atop a heap of dirty clothes. I picked it up, wincing at the smell, with the idea of throwing it over the painting while I found a better place to hide it. Maybe in the...
"What are you doing?"
My father stood in the doorway, a darkish silhouette with the light shining behind him.
"Nothing."
He stooped and picked up the bag I'd dropped in the hall.
"What's this out here?"
"My book bag," I said after a pause. Though the thing was clearly a mom's collapsible shopping tote, nothing I or any kid would ever take to school. He tossed it in the open door, crinkling his nose at the smell.
Phew,
he said, waving his hand in front of his face. It smells like old hockey socks in here. As he reached inside the door and flipped the light switch, I managed, with a complex but spasmodic movement, to throw the towel over the picture so, I hoped, he couldn't see it.
What's that you've got there?
A poster.
Well, look, I hope you're not planning to haul a lot of junk out to Vegas. No need to pack your winter clothes. You won't need them, except maybe some ski stuff. You won't believe the skiing in Tahoe. Not like these icy little mountains upstate.
I felt that I needed to make a reply, especially since it was the longest and friendliest-seeming thing he'd said since he'd shown up. But somehow I couldn't quite pull my thoughts together.
Abruptly, my father said, "Your mother wasn't so easy to live with either, you know."
He picked up something that looked like an old math test from my desk, examined it, and then threw it back down.
"She played her cards way too close to the vest. You know how she used to do. Clamming up, freezing me out. Always had to take the high road. It was a power thing, you know? Really controlling. Quite honestly, and I really hate to say this, it got to the point where it was hard for me to even be in the same room with her. I mean, I'm not saying she was a bad person. It's just, one minute everything's fine, and the next, bam, what did I do? The old silent treatment."
I said nothing, standing there awkwardly with the mildewy towel draped over the painting and the light shining into my eyes, wishing that I was anywhere else, Tibet, Lake Tahoe, the moon, and not trusting myself to reply. What he'd said about my mother was perfectly true. Often she was uncommunicative, and when she was upset, it was difficult to tell what she was thinking. But I wasn't interested in a discussion of my mother's faults, and at any rate, they seemed like fairly minor faults compared to my father's. My father was saying,
"Because I've got nothing to prove, see? Every game has two sides. It's not an issue of who's right and who's wrong. And sure, I'll admit, I'm to blame for some of it too. Although I'll say this, and I'm sure you know it too. She sure did have a way of rewriting history in her own favor."
It was strange to be in the room with him again, especially as he was so different. He gave off a different smell almost, and there was a different heaviness and weight to him, a sleekness as though padded all over with a smooth half inch of fat.
"I guess a lot of marriages run into problems like ours. She'd just gotten so bitter, you know? And withholding. Honestly, I just didn't feel like I could live with her any longer. Though God knows she didn't deserve this."
She sure didn't, I thought.
"Because you know what this was really about, don't you?" said my dad, leaning on the door frame with one elbow and looking at me shrewdly. "Me leaving? I had to withdraw some money from our bank account to pay taxes, and she flipped her lid like I'd stolen it."
He was watching me very carefully, looking for my response.
"Our joint bank account. I mean, basically, when the chips were down, she didn't trust me. Her own husband."
I didn't know what to say. It was the first I'd heard about the taxes, although it was certainly no secret that my mother didn't trust my dad where money was concerned.
"God, but she could hold on to a grievance,"
he said with a half-humorous wince, wiping his hand down the front of his face.
"Tit for tat. Always looking to even the score. Because, I mean it, she never forgot anything. If she had to wait 20 years, she was going to get you back. And sure, I'm the one who always looks like the bad guy, and maybe I am the bad guy."
The painting, though small, was getting heavy, and my face felt frozen with the effort of concealing my discomfort. In order to block his voice out, I started counting to myself in Spanish. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis. By the time I'd reached 29, Zandra had appeared.
"Larry,"
she said,
"you and your wife had a really nice place here."
The way she said it made me feel bad for her, without liking her any better. My dad put his arm around her waist and drew her to him with sort of a kneading motion that made me sick.
"Well," he said modestly, "it's really more hers than mine."
You can say that again, I thought.
"Come in here,"
said my dad, catching her by the hand and leading her away towards my mother's bedroom, all thought of me forgotten. I want you to see something. I turned and watched them go, queasy at the prospect of Xandra and my father pawing through my mother's things, but so glad to see them go, I didn't care. With one eye on the empty doorway, I walked around to the far side of my bed and propped the painting out of sight. An old New York Post lay on the floor, the same newspaper that she'd thrown into me in a flap on our last Saturday together.
"Here, kiddo," she'd said, sticking her head in at the door. "Pick a movie."
Though there were several movies we both would have liked, I'd chosen a matinee at the Boris Karloff Film Festival, The Body Snatcher. She had accepted my choice without a word of complaint. We'd gone down to Film Forum, watched the movie, and after it was over, walked to Moondance Diner for a hamburger. A perfectly pleasant Saturday afternoon, apart from the fact that it was her last on Earth. And now I felt rotten whenever I thought about it, since, thanks to me, the last movie she'd ever seen was a corny old horror flick about corpses and grave robbing. If I'd picked the movie I knew she wanted to see, the well-reviewed one about Parisian children during World War I, might she have lived somehow? My thoughts often ran along on such dark, superstitious fault lines. Though the newspaper felt sacrosanct, an historical document, I turned it to the middle and took it apart. Grimly, I wrapped the painting, sheet by sheet, and taped it up with the same tape I'd used a few months before to wrap my mother's Christmas present.
"Perfect," she'd said,
in a storm of colored paper, leaning in her bathrobe to kiss me. A watercolor set she would never be carrying to the park. On Saturday mornings in summer, she would never see. My bed, a brass camp bed from the flea market, soldierly and reassuring, had always seemed like the safest place in the world to hide something. But now, looking around, beat-up desk, Japanese Godzilla poster, the penguin mug from the zoo that I used as a pencil cup, the impermanence of it all struck me hard, and I felt dizzy to think of all our things flying out of the apartment, furniture and silver and all my mother's clothes, sample sale dresses with the tags still on them, all those colored ballet slippers and tailored shirts with her initials on the cuff, chairs and Chinese lamps, old jazz records on vinyl that she'd bought down in the village, jars of marmalade and olives, and sharp German mustard in the refrigerator. In the bathroom, a bewilderment of perfumed oils and moisturizers, colored bubble bath, half-empty bottles of overpriced shampoo crowded on the side of the tub, Kiehl's, chlorine, Kerastase. My mother always had 5 or 6 kinds going. How could the apartment have seemed so permanent and solid-looking when it was only a stage set, waiting to be struck and carried away by movers in uniform? Walking into the living room, I was confronted by a sweater of my mother's lying across the chair where she'd left it, a sky-blue ghost of her. Shells we'd picked up on the beach at Wellfleet. Hyacinths, which she'd bought at the Korean market a few days before she died, with the stems draped dead black and rotten over the side of the pot. In the wastebasket, catalogs from Dover Books, Belgian shoes, a wrapper from a pack of Necco wafers, which had been her favorite candy. I picked it up and sniffed it. The sweater, I knew, would smell of her too if I picked it up and put it to my face, yet even the sight of it was unendurable. I went back in my bedroom and stood on my desk chair and got down my suitcase, which was soft-sided and not too big, and packed it full of clean underwear, clean school clothes, and folded shirts from the laundry. Then I put in the painting, with another layer of clothes on top. I zipped the suitcase, no lock, but it was only canvas, and stood very still. Then I went out into the hall. I could hear drawers opening and shutting in my mother's bedroom. A giggle. "Dad," I said in a loud voice, "I'm going downstairs and talk to Jose." Their voices went dead silent.
"You bet,"
said my father, through the closed door, in an unnaturally cordial tone. I went back and got the suitcase and walked out of the apartment with it, leaving the front door cracked so I could get back in. Then I rode the elevator down, staring into the mirror that faced me, trying hard not to think about Xandra in my mother's bedroom, pawing through her clothes. Had he been seeing her before he left home? Didn't he feel even a bit creepy about permitting her to root around in my mother's things? I was walking to the front door where Jose was on duty, when a voice called, "Wait a sec." Turning, I saw Goldie hurrying from the package room. "Theo, my God, I'm sorry," he said. We stood looking at each other for an uncertain moment, and then, in an impulsive what-the-hell movement, so awkward it was almost funny, he reached around and hugged me. "So sorry," he repeated, shaking his head. "My God, what a thing." Goldie, since his divorce, often worked nights and holidays, standing at the doors with his gloves off and an unlit cigarette in his hand, looking out at the street. My mother had sometimes sent me down with coffee and donuts for him when he was down in the lobby by himself. No company but the lighted tree and the electric menorah, sorting out the newspapers by himself at 5 a.m. on Christmas Day. And the expression on his face reminded me of those dead holiday mornings, empty-looking stare, his face ashy and uncertain, in the lonely, unguarded moment before he saw me and put on his best, "Hi, kid," smile. "I've been thinking about you and your mother so much," he said, wiping his brow. "Ay, bendito, I don't even know what you must be going through." "Yeah," I said, looking away. "It's been hard," which was, for whatever reason, the phrase I constantly fell back upon when people told me how sorry they were. I'd had to say it so much that it was starting to come out sounding glib and a bit phony.
"I'm glad you stopped by," said Goldie. "That morning? I was on duty, you remember? Right out front there?"
"Sure I do," I said, wondering at his urgency, as if he thought I might not remember.
"Oh, my God."
He passed his hand over his forehead, a little wild-looking, as if he himself had suffered only a narrow escape.
"I think about it every single day. I still see her face, you know, getting into that cab, waving goodbye, so happy."
Confidentially, he leaned forward.
"When I heard she died," he said, as if telling me a big secret, "I called up my ex-wife, that's how upset I was."
He pulled back and looked at me with raised eyebrows, as if he didn't expect me to believe him. Goldie's battles with his ex-wife were epic.
"I mean, we hardly talk," he said. "But who am I gonna tell? I gotta tell somebody, you know? So I called her up and told her, 'Rosa, you can't believe it. We lost such a beautiful lady from the building.'"
Jose, spotting me, had strolled back from the front door to join our conversation in his distinctive springy walk.
"Mrs. Decker,"
he said, shaking his head fondly as if there had never been anyone like her.
"Always say hello. Always such a nice smile. Considerate, you know? Not like some of these people in the building," said Goldie, glancing over his shoulder. "You know,"
he leaned closer and mouthed the word,
"snobby. The kind of person stands there empty-handed with no packages or nothing and waits for you to open the door, is what I'm saying." "She wasn't like that,"
said Jose, still shaking his head, big head movements like a somber child saying no.
"Mrs. Decker was class A." "Say, will you wait here a second?"
Goldie said, holding up his hand.
"I'll be right back. Don't leave. Don't let him leave," he said to Jose as he was backing away. "You want me to get you a cab, manito?"
said Jose, eyeing the suitcase.
"No,"
I said, glancing back at the elevator.
"Listen, Jose, will you keep this for me until I come back and get it?"
"Sure,"
he said, picking it up and hefting it.
"Happy to."
"I'll come back for it myself, okay? Don't let anybody else have it."
"Sure, I get it,"
said Jose pleasantly. I followed him into the package room, where he tagged the bag and hoisted it onto a top shelf.
"You see,"
he said,
"out of the way, baby. We don't keep nothing up high there, except some packages people got to sign for, and our own personal stuff. Nobody's going to release that bag to you without your personal signature. You understand? Not your uncle, your cousin, nobody. And I'll tell Carlos and Goldie and the other guys, don't give that bag to nobody but you. Okay?
I was nodding, about to thank him, when Jose cleared his throat.
Listen,